The second case for oral argument this morning is Heather Robnick, appellant versus American Family Insurance Group, appellee, and Shirley Hunter, appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Michael Wilson, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, American Family Insurance Company, is Mr. Douglas Dibert, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Conan Camp has disqualified himself, and we are very pleased to welcome back an old friend, the Honorable Richard Savers, who served as a justice of this court for many years, and welcome back. With that, Mr. Wilson, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. This case will determine whether a person who buys liability insurance and then commits the tort of negligent misrepresentation will be treated by her insurance company and the courts like all other insured persons who commit negligent acts, or whether she will be instead treated like those who commit the intentional tort of deceit. These are the facts. Shirley Hunter paid American Family for liability insurance coverage at all times relevant here. Number two, Shirley Hunter negligently misrepresented certain facts about her home while the American Family policy was in force. Number three, Hunter's negligent misrepresentation caused Heather Robnick to suffer bodily injury and physical damage to her property while the policy was in force. Number four, American Family promised in its policy it would pay compensatory damages for which Hunter was legally liable because of bodily injury or property damage caused by occurrences covered by the policy. Number five, American Family defined an occurrence as an accident which results during the policy period in bodily injury or property damage. Number six, American Family did not define the word accident in its policy. Number seven, Heather Robnick sued Hunter for damages. American Family intervened in that lawsuit and participated in that trial. Number eight, after hearing all of the evidence in the case, Judge Trimble awarded compensatory damages to my client, Heather Robnick, and ruled, number one, Hunter was negligent in her completion of the real property disclosure form, and number two, that negligence caused Robnick bodily injury and physical damage to property. Now, rather than keeping its contractual promise, American Family made a motion for summary judgment in this declaratory judgment lawsuit and made four claims. The first claim was that the misrepresentation didn't cause the injury, the bodily injury, or the property damage. In effect, American Family asked Judge Delaney to disregard the ruling of Judge Trimble, which he did. The second claim made by American Family was that there was no policy in force during the relevant time. This was a claim later abandoned. The third claim made with this was that this was not an accident. American Family said this was not an accident relying upon a California case, the Miller case. California is a state which treats negligent misrepresentation as a subspecies or variety of fraud. And the fourth claim made by American Family was that coverage for negligent completion of the real property disclosure statement was excluded by the policy's contract exclusion. Now, Judge Delaney granted summary judgment for American Family and held sua sponte that Hunter's statements were intentional acts as a matter of law. The policy had an exclusion for intentional injury, not intentional acts, but intentional injury.
Are you raising a question of fact argument here, or are you saying you should win as a matter of law? Is this just merely an interpretation of the policy?
I am saying that there is no question of fact on the issues of negligence, causation, or damages that are covered damages under the policy. The issue before this court is whether Judge Delaney improvidently granted summary judgment. He did so because he violated the rule of res judicata and made factual findings that differed from those which were previously made.
So you're arguing that you should win outright.
I should win out. We should win outright. I'm asking you, Your Honor, to set aside the grant of summary judgment made for American Family, to also reverse the denial of summary judgment rendered against my client, and rule that these are compensatory damages covered in the policy.
Thank you.
Yes, that's the relief I seek. Now, Judge Delaney said these statements were an intentional act as a matter of law without any factual support for that claim. There's an exclusion in this policy for intentional injury. We will not cover damage caused intentionally, the policy says. We will not cover damage caused intentionally. Judge Delaney also ruled that this representation didn't cause the damage. Again, defying or disregarding, perhaps, the
rule. What was Judge Delaney's rationale for not following the, for being bound by the previous rulings of Judge Turnbull?
I'm not sure. It wasn't articulated.
All right.
Why he didn't feel bound. Mr. Dibert, on argument, conceded that res judicata applied to those rulings, but he felt that Judge Delaney said in his letter opinion that these are intentional acts no matter what Judge Trimble called them.
I'm assuming you protected your record by raising it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Judge Delaney's grant of summary judgment should be reversed for two reasons. Hunter's false disclosure statement doesn't constitute deceit as a matter of law. When you sign a disclosure statement, when you sell your house, if you make a false statement, that does not constitute an intentional misrepresentation as a matter of law, because there's got to be scienter in South Dakota for a misrepresentation to rise to the level of deceit. It's not like the difference between negligence and gross negligence, which is just more and more negligence. They are two different creatures. Negligent misrepresentation is completely different from the intentional tort of deceit. They are not more or less of the same thing. They are different things. The issue of causation, of course,
that's by statute.
That's by case law. And, it's, you know, 2010-2 and 2010-1 is the deceit statute in South Dakota, and there's a body of case law that says that scienter is an essential element. The intent to deceive is an essential element for deceit.
But a jury could find that the act was intentional and still render a negligent misrepresentation verdict.
I respectfully disagree.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I understand your argument that the elements are different and that there's that you can't have intentional and negligent act in theory at the same time. But if a case is submitted to a jury or a judge, a fact finder, only under one theory, the act could be more egregious than merely negligence, you'd still be entitled to a negligence verdict.
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. The reason I say that is the Robertson case that I cited was tried on two theories, negligence and intentional tort, intentional deceit. The jury clicked both boxes on the jury interrogatories, and the case was reversed because the appellate court said you can't have both. One act cannot be simultaneously intentional and unintentional. It is either or. That's what I believe is the case law, and that's what Judge Delaney asked us to submit a point brief on after the initial hearing was, can an act be at the same time negligent and intentional? And the case law, as cited in my brief, the Robertson case, and there's also a South Dakota case said in my brief, which name is gone now, says the same thing.
How could these misrepresentations be unintentional? I mean, they had to have the intention to make the misrepresentation. So how can they be unintentional?
Well, the utterance might be an intentionally made utterance, but the consequence is unintended. It's no different than placing a rake on that step over there. You intend to lay the rake down when you're going to go pick your flowers, but when you don't intend for someone to come down the steps and fall. So, and that really is the nub of this case. The nub of this case is an accident. An accident is an unintended consequence of an intentional act. So Justice Sabers, indeed, these statements were made volitionally, but there was no intention to cause harm, no intention to deceive, as determined by Judge Trimble.
Do we look to the, are we bound by the allegations in the underlying complaint, or do we look behind that as to the facts and record, as far as whether it was negligent misrepresentation versus intentional?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
My understanding is that the complaint was amended down in the underlying action to allege only negligent misrepresentation.
True.
Are we bound by that characterization, or do we have the authority to go behind it and look to the facts in the record?
I think you are bound by the final judgment of Judge Trimble, the findings of fact and conclusions of law, which he rendered after hearing all of the evidence, which American Family chose not to appeal, in which he said that this is an act of negligence.
Did American Family in the underlying action object to the findings or the conclusions, whichever, where it was at, on negligent misrepresentation?
Their objections, and I don't know if those were part of the record on in the DEC action. I know that the findings and conclusions were. I'm not sure whether the objections were in the record, but I do recollect that there was no proposed finding that this constitutes deceit. The findings were more akin to, this is not supported by the evidence, this is not supported by the law, kind of general objection to the findings and conclusions. No affirmative, you should have said this was deceit. And you know, at the time of the trial, there's took a little chance, because at that time, Shirley Hunter is long gone, and we've got two theories to present to Judge Trimble. When we dismissed as the conclusion of the case the intentional tort claims, we took a little chance, because Judge Trimble could have said, this is deceit, and you just dismissed your cause of action, so tough luck, Mr. Wilson and your client. Call the carrier. But instead, we produced evidence to suggest that this was not necessarily deceit in every circumstance. This might easily have been an inadvertence or a mistake or some other unintentional harm, and Judge Trimble said, this is negligence, and this caused damage, and that's all there is to it, and awarded those compensatory damages. The American Family relies upon the Miller case from California, and that's really the heart of this whole argument that we're having, I think. The Miller case is a case involving a sale of property. There's a lawsuit for misrepresentation and concealment. The appellate court in California in the Miller case said that misrepresentation requires an intent to induce reliance and is a subspecies or variety of fraud that is excluded from coverage. So like your question, Justice Sabers, is this an intentional act? Yet the answer is that the statements were made volitionally, but without intention to cause harm. The Miller case also had that misrepresentation, whether intentional or negligent, is no accident. But that misses the whole point of the question, because in South Dakota, we have always treated, this court has always treated negligence different than intentional tort. Always. There's no South Dakota case precedent that I could find that would suggest that negligent misrepresentation is some subspecies or variety of fraud, which is the California line of cases. And to stuff negligent misrepresentation into the intentional tort area, it does great disservice to all other negligent acts. A negligent act is an intentional act with unintended consequences. It's an accident.
I mean, that takes you right, I think, into your line of authorities. As you point out in your brief, there's a split of authority in the country on the issue.
Yes, sir.
And you adopt, you'd like us to apply the, what I call, I guess, the Sheets line of authorities.
There are several cases, Sheets, Wood, Aetna, several cases.
And all those cases, they don't really look at the act of the actor. They look at the damages and whether there was foresight or expectation of those kinds of damages, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's what you're asking us to apply in this case?
That's true.
Now, with respect to that, I noticed that Judge Trimble, his findings of fact, all focus on the act of filling out the disclosure statement. But they don't focus on whether or not the person filling out the disclosure statement had foresight or expectation that this kind of damage would occur if the person didn't know that they hadn't fixed the sewer problems in this house. So is res judicata really applicable here when I didn't see any findings of fact from Judge Trimble that related to the question of foresight or expectation of damages as opposed to the act of failing to fill out the disclosure statement?
I'm not so sure that Judge Trimble did reach or make a finding on that particular issue, but again, I believe that once you find that an act is caused negligently, it implies or assumes that it was not caused with the intention to do harm. The finding of negligence precludes any suggestion that the harm was either intended or expected or ought to have been by design. I think by implication and by necessity, the finding of negligence forecloses any of those other looking at the quality of the results issues.
Well, I kind of wonder if it does, because in the Sheets case, the court discussed all the views and said that it was conceivable there was coverage in that case. And the court said it was conceivable because the Sheets had never had a problem. And ironically, that was a sewer system problem too. And they said they'd never had a problem while they were living there. And they said, we therefore hold that the resulting damages fit within the definition of an accident because it wasn't within their foresight or expectation because they'd never had the sewer problem before. Here we have a case where the seller of this house had the sewer problem. Rather than fixing it, they capped the shower, they capped the toilet, took the toilet out. I mean, they pretty much had to know that if somebody tried to use the shower or the toilet in that basement, there was going to be flooding down there again. Don't you think?
Well, that was the issue before Judge Trimble. That was the precise issue before Judge Trimble is, don't you think if they did all those things, they must have intended to deceive? But he didn't find the tort of deceit. He found the tort of negligence. And I believe that is mutually exclusive.
But again, each of his findings go to the act of filling out the disclosure statement. There's not one finding that relates to whether or not the owner of this house should have foreseen or expected this kind of damage for not telling the truth, so to speak, on the disclosure statement.
The issue that you raised with regard to the Sheets case was a quarrel in the court about whether to adopt those line of cases that says that if an act is expected or foreseen, there's coverage. Another line of cases says if an act is unforeseeable and unexpected, there is no coverage. That
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. That was the debate in Sheets. The Sheets court resolved the issue by saying that in a tort case, the tortfeasor is only legally responsible for damages that are reasonably foreseeable. And so the Sheets case said, then why buy insurance if you're not going to cover damages that are reasonable and foreseeable? Why would you even have a policy of insurance that excluded reasonably foreseeable damages? And that was the debate in Sheets, really, was whether to make all insurance contracts illusory and have no coverage for foreseeable consequences, or instead, if the act is foreseeable or expected subjectively, then there ought to be coverage, and that is indeed an accident. And again, the Sheets case and the Woods case and all those cases discuss that very proposition, which is this an accident? is an occurrence like this an accident? I want to wrap up and say that we are seeking damages here really for the reliance interest, okay, not the expectation interest here. We relied upon these representations, and we had a flood because we relied upon them. We aren't seeking damages for the expectation interest, which is make the house like you promised it would have been. And all those cases cited by American Family, the Lenning case and the Nationwide case, those cases are cases seeking economic loss for misrepresentation. We aren't seeking that. This is a tort case, not a contract case. We're seeking damages for relying upon the negligence, misrepresentation. And because of that, we'd ask you again to reverse the judgment, granting summary judgment for American Family, reverse the judgment denying Robnick's motion for summary judgment, and declare that the compensatory damages awarded to Robnick by Judge Trimble arose from a covered occurrence under this policy.
Do you agree that the owner did intend to protect the sale, to eliminate the risk of reduction in the price or the loss of the sale? Do you agree that the owner intended that?
No.
Why not?
I don't concede that because there's no facts in the record to support that. She didn't testify. For all we knew, this was another stack of papers that you sign when you sell your house. My daughter takes the ACT test. She earnestly endeavors to fill out every blank correctly, and sometimes she gets them wrong, even though she knows the right answer. I'm not suggesting what this lady intended or didn't intend. I'm just telling you there's no facts in the record to support your assertion, Justice.
You think the owner got the wrong answer here?
I don't know that. I don't know if she thought this had been fixed. I don't know if she thought there was going to be no problem. I don't know if she thought it wasn't material. I don't know if she got the wrong answer. There's no facts to support that question of fact on intent.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Dibbert, you have 20 minutes. Sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices, may it please this court, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson read 7 or 8 statements at the beginning of his argument, most of which I certainly agree with. And this is a significant case in an insurance coverage, rather relating to an insurance coverage issue, which is going to have significant ramifications and far-reaching effects on any liability policies, not just relating to sale of real estate. I'd like to propose two factual scenarios. An individual is a convicted sex offender. He applies for a job at a school or a daycare center, something like that. He has a homeowner's policy. And on the employment application, he fails to disclose the prior conviction. He is hired, engages in sexual contact with one of the children. A lawsuit results. He alleges, the plaintiff alleges that the applicant offender negligently completed the insurance application. Damages are awarded against the offender. If this court holds in this situation that completing a real estate disclosure form or any form that later damage occurs, there would be coverage in that situation. Same example, an individual, another homeowner with a homeowner's policy, fills out an application for credit, let's say at a bank. He omits information including a prior bankruptcy filing and some other issues with his credit. He defaults on the loan. The bank sues him. This argument Mr. Wilson is making is accepted, there would be coverage for the damages the bank sustained. If I can digress just 1 minute during the argument, something triggered this. There is a case, and it's listed in a laundry list type of cases of mine, American Family versus Purdy, the sexual contact case, I think in 1992, and I was prepared to indicate that none of the members of the court were on the court at that time, but Justice Sabers filling in now. Justice Sabers very ably authored that opinion. That case involved sexual contact with a young man with two of the neighbor boys. It was sued under the theory, and it was the expected or intended standard exclusion in a homeowner's policy. It was sued that the individual, the perpetrator, negligently and without the intent to injure, did molest these kids. The trial court found in favor of the plaintiffs in coverage. We appealed it. This court unanimously reversed that decision. And significantly, even though this is painted as negligence, at the bottom of one of the pages, and I didn't have the case with me, I can just see it, it's the left-hand, one of the left-hand pages, there's a footnote that lists the findings of fact, and one of them is the perpetrator thought he was effecting some act of love on the children, and another finding was that he didn't expect anything bad, and it might even have some good consequences for them. Well, this court rejected those findings, as this court should reject findings here that are just inconsistent with reality.
But aren't you a day late? You didn't appeal the findings from the first case.
That's true, I did not, but I would urge that res judicata should not apply to this case, and I'll get to that in just a minute. Here's my quandary. At trial in the main case, and on the damage case, I think it was before the evidence, maybe it was after, as Mr. Wilson argued. The case was sued in February of 07, I believe. The bench trial, which took about an hour, occurred in July of 08. The entire time it had been sued as alternative negligence or deceit. At trial, Mr. Wilson moved to amend the complaint to get rid of the deceit charge. And I think it's very clear, and Mr. Wilson should be given all the credit in the world for doing everything he can for his client, but it was clearly to, I think, effect at least an attempt at coverage. So my quandary, well, now do I object? Well, I didn't. And so it was tried only on negligence, and indeed that is what the court found. The significant case...
Well, just a minute, though. We got to stop right there because, I mean, after those concessions, these four findings by Judge Trimble regarding negligent acts, I mean, that is, you are collaterally stopped from taking issue with that in this case. I mean, you were there, you intervened on behalf of the carrier, and those findings were adopted, not objected to. Aren't we bound by Judge Trimble's finding that this disclosure statement was negligently completed?
Justice Zinner, to address that, first of all, we did object, but we did not appeal it. But my primary argument on the res judicata issue is based on the Smithy case, Dakota Plains versus Smithy at 772 Northwest 2nd. Very clearly and several times, this court noted, in order for res judicata to apply, cause of action in the prior litigation must be the same as the cause of action in the subsequent litigation. And at page 180, if the wrong sought to be redressed is the same in both actions, then res judicata applies. Well, that's not the case here. The first case was a property damage case. This is an insurance coverage case.
Well, but there's a problem there. The problem there is there's two preclusive effects of res judicata. There's issue preclusion and claim preclusion. And that case is talking about claim preclusion. You can't bring a second lawsuit. What Mr. Wilson's arguing here is issue preclusion. He's arguing that these specific issues or findings are precluded from relitigation.
And I'm urging that under the Smithy case, that shouldn't be the case, Justice Zinner. Now,
but doesn't res judicata cover all the issues that were tried and all of the issues that could have been tried?
That is the general definition of res judicata, yes.
And why doesn't that apply here?
In other words, the trial court entered findings of fact that Judge Trimble entered the findings of fact proposed by Mr. Wilson, and as everyone having been a circuit court judge knows how that goes, but should have had nothing to do with coverage issues, partly because if you look at the policy provisions, it will cover damages for bodily injury or property damage caused by an occurrence. Now, signing that disclosure statement didn't cause anything. It was the failure to disclose the fact there had been prior plumbing problems, a capped line, and other things, which didn't occur until about a year after closing.
But shouldn't you bring your declaratory judgment soon, first, I mean?
There was no notice of the loss until this case was filed. And I don't know how else to answer that, Justice Sabers. We
follow up on that. Wouldn't they have had to try the underlying case? Didn't you have to? I mean, wasn't this a...
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I think that's true because we had to know what the damages were, which would be true in some but not all declaratory judgment action types of cases.
Was any of that discussed prior to the original case? Was there a claim made and that... Nothing like that.
There wasn't. The first notice, and this is not in the record, but of course there was no car accident where a report would be generated or a slip and fall or where someone would call their insurance company. No, the first notice was the lawsuit.
The original lawsuit?
Correct, the Robnik versus Hunter lawsuit.
I want to take you back to Smithy. You're correct. Under Smithy, you would not be barred from bringing this second cause of action by res judicata. But that doesn't mean that you're not barred from relitigating an issue that was litigated in the first case.
Well, I would...
Smithy doesn't say that.
Yeah, Justice Inner, I understand your point. I would still urge that in getting to these other issues within the policy that the underlying lawsuit did not address those, particularly in an insurance declaratory judgment context. And if this court holds that whether res judicata or collateral estoppel apply to where American Family is unable to assert these issues now, then I guess I've discussed this kind of jokingly with Mr. Wilson that I guess I'll come in second again. Getting back to the policy, though, one of the other, number two, an occurrence means an accident. Give that any definition you want. Which results during the policy period in bodily injury or property damage? Now, that disclosure form was filled out in December of, I can't keep the year straight, I think it was 02, maybe it was 03. At any rate, closing occurred 2 months later. It was 04, that's right. The damage, the big problem, occurred January 1st of 2005, 13 months after the form was completed, 10 months after the closing on the property, at which time Hunter was no longer insured under the property. Thus, the damage, the property damage and emotional distress did not result during the policy period. Now, the other thing, paragraph 11, exclusion 11, property damage means physical damage to or destruction of tangible property. Now, that means if someone falls down, breaks their arm, that's an occurrence. It meets all the definitions there. But this was not damage to tangible property caused by anything.
Well, how can you say that when you've got a basement full of sewage? That sounds to me like personal property.
It's not good, I can tell you that. But the point is, the act of filling out that disclosure form did not cause that damage. It was the underlying problem, which wasn't disclosed.
Well, you know, it did. It did in the sense that they probably wouldn't have turned the thing on without fixing it if the owner would have disclosed what happened. It's kind of the but-for rule, but so maybe there is some causation there.
There are all kinds of, I guess, door number one, door number two types of things where you can go with that, Justice Sabers, but I would still urge that it was not the completion of the real estate disclosure form which caused the property damage. In occurrence, you know, in the true sense of a homeowner's policy, somebody trips and falls in your front yard because you have an elevation change in the sidewalk or you didn't get your snow and ice off, it occurs right then, not 10 months later. It occurred during the policy period, and it was
making some wonderful arguments about the definition of occurrence. You wrote the policy. You could have defined that. You didn't do it.
Well, at any level, Justice Gilbertson, something gets down to the lowest common denominator, and it's defined as an accident. Now, I suppose the policy could go through a more of a definition of accident, But give it the most, construed in the best light to the plaintiff, give that to Robnik, give it that definition, and it still won't be an occurrence resulting in the property damage or bodily injury. The other thing
I want to take you back to cause for just a moment, follow up on Justice Saber's question, that, you know, most of the cases that have found no cause have said your exact point. Obviously, failing to fill out the disclosure statement is not the cause of sewage backing into the basement. But in this case, the buyer bought the home in reliance on a disclosure statement which said there were no sewer problems. And the sewer's capped off, the drain in the shower's capped, the toilet's capped. They go down, uncap them, they read the disclosure statement, they see no problems, they uncap them, they start to use them. You have causation in that kind of a situation, don't you?
Well, I'd urge that that's not correct, Justice Zinner, and I'm trying to think of a better response, but the completion of the disclosure statement did not cause the property damage. If you trip over a crack in my sidewalk, that's caused by my negligence. If I hit a golf ball and strike Justice Meyer Henry as she's going by in the bike path, that's an occurrence. It's caused by the negligent act. But here, the act of completing the form didn't cause the property damage. It was the fact there was an underlying condition that wasn't disclosed, didn't happen until 13 months after the completion of the form, 10 months after the closing on the property. And to get from dot A to dot B, it doesn't occur here as it does in a true occurrence or a true accident.
But say you've been looking at the form, you're the buyer, and it truthfully says on there, we capped the toilet because we had backup problems. Wouldn't that have precluded you from doing what happens here, putting in a toilet, and then you'll get a basement full of sewage?
Probably so. And I don't know how to address that any better, Chief Justice. Than to say again, it was not the act of completing the form negligently or intentionally, like a batted ball or that sort of situation.
Mr. Dagger, I didn't read the policy. Is this a claims made or is this an occurrence?
Occurrence.
I assume it's an occurrence policy by most homeowners.
Yes, occurrence. Yes, Your Honor. Justice Stevenson.
So if it was, well, you don't have to have both the claim policy in existence at the same, or the damage in the policy in existence at the same time, just the occurrence of the incident.
Well, the occurrence must result, the occurrence being completing the form, must result during the policy period in the BI or the PD. That didn't happen here. There was no damage until 10 months after closing. I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
The last thing that really hasn't been addressed is the contractual exclusion. I don't know what could be more clear, but the fact that this is a contract, or at least part of one, it's a piece of paper, you make representations, there's consideration.
Okay, but wouldn't that assume that the disclosure agreement is contracted liabilities? Usually that claim is made where someone agrees to assume liability.
Well, I think it's... I've often tried to think that through that as well, Justice Everson. I've often thought that that exists in either a CGL or a homeowner's or any other type of policy, because with a contract, are you taking on liabilities you wouldn't ordinarily take on? For instance, driving a car or maintaining your sidewalk, you're responsible for those kinds of things. When you sign a real estate disclosure form, and it could be for a million-dollar sale of a house that goes south, disclose something that goes south, the company didn't expect to insure those types of occurrences. That the expansion of liability based on contract, I think, is the basic reason for that exclusion. And just to make the point before I forget it, I don't know if it's being argued that it's not a contract, but at page 15 of the appellant's brief, or maybe the reply brief, it specifically concedes that we're talking about contractual language, so we are talking about a contract.
Mr. Dagger, I noticed that if I read it correctly, I didn't see in your brief where you addressed the language in the policy, which is an exception to the contract exclusion. And that says that the exclusion does not apply if it relates to the ownership, maintenance, or use of the insured premises.
Well,
that seems to me that that's what's going on here, isn't it?
Well, no, it's because of the fact that it goes beyond the ownership, maintenance, or use of the insured premises when Ms. Hunter signed the real estate disclosure statement, be it negligently or intentionally. Thus, it does not come within the exception of the exclusion.
Well, it says the exclusion does not apply to contracts directly relating to the ownership, maintenance, or use. And this disclosure statement is something relating to the premises, the insured premises.
It's relating to the sale. It's not relating to the ownership, maintenance, or use of the property. It's beyond that. It's a it's beyond the scope of that exception, I believe. I would get back to the policy, Justices. Number one, the bodily injury and property damage were not caused by an occurrence. The occurrence or accident, whatever you're talking about, did not result during the policy period, and it did not result in bodily injury or property damage. The entire theory in the complaint in the main case was the completion of the real estate disclosure form. There was no physical damage to or destruction of tangible property. A car didn't get damaged. A person's arm didn't get damaged. Rather, this was because of an underlying defect that wasn't disclosed. And finally, we urge that the contractual liability exclusion applies. For any or all of these reasons, Justices, we would urge that this decision of Judge Laney's be affirmed in all respects to avoid the result in the examples I started with, which would be a logical extension of this. And a liability policy simply does not extend to negligent or intentional omissions from a contractual document. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. David. Mr. Wilson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Let me begin, if I may, that this case was not tried only on negligence. The complaint alleged negligent tort and intentional tort. The motion to dismiss the intentional tort counts did not come until the conclusion of the trial. That's conceded by appellant or by American Family in its brief and in the statements of material fact leading up to that. Number two, Mr. Dibert said damage did not result during the policy period. Again, I refer you to Defendant Robnick's Supplemental Statement of Undisputed Material Facts, attached as page A28 of my brief. Paragraph 1 said, from sometime in 2002 until March 11, 2008, that's the whole time here, Shirley Hunter had a policy of liability insurance coverage issued by American Family. And American Family, in the subsequent pleading, said, we agree with all matters set forth in that supplemental statement of facts. So there's no question there was coverage in force when the utterance was made and when the sewage backed up and when the damage was caused. That's off the table. I would ask you this, is what if the negligent misrepresentation didn't have to do with whether there were sewer problems? Imagine that Mr. Dibert came to my house in Rapid City and we had supper and there was an ice storm. And I was gone for a few minutes and I told him that I've sprinkled some salt on my sidewalk. That I misrepresent to him that now I've made my sidewalk safe. And then Doug comes across my steps and hits the unsanded ice on my sidewalk and goes down and lands on him and hurts himself. Would there be any question that that is an act of either negligence or deceit that's treated as an occurrence under the policy? Would there be any question that misrepresentation would be treated just like if I laid the rake on the steps or the hose across the steps or shove Doug down the stairs? Would there be any doubt that we were talking about one of two things, an act of negligence or an act of intentional harm? The fact that this is misrepresentation shouldn't change the equation. Negligent misrepresentation ought to be treated like all other forms of negligence. And if there's a question of fact about whether I intended to hurt Mr. Dybert by lying to him about my salted sidewalk, or maybe I just thought I got it cleaned up and was negligent about that, that question of fact is resolved by the finder of fact. And that's been found.
Of course, the problem with that is that negligent misrepresentation has an intent element in it, which is really unlike most other negligent torts that we deal with. Specifically, it requires intent to induce a particular action by the other party. So negligent misrepresentation is a different animal.
It's somewhat different, but as I understand, under Restatement Section 552, there must only be an acknowledgement that the information will be used for an important purpose. There's no intention to deceive element, and I'm not so sure there's an intent to induce reliance, but even if there is, when you drive down the highway, don't you have the right to assume that all other peoples will obey the law and behave non-negligently? And so I think that conceptually, everybody who's operating in the public has the right to assume that others will not behave negligently. And because of that, there's an acknowledgement by all of us that we are expected to behave non-negligently, that even though we make a remark that's intended to induce reliance, it's the difference between that tort and the tort of deceit is the intent to do harm. And that hasn't been shown here. And that's what distinguishes all these cases, plus the fact that we're suing for reliance damages, not expectation damages here. We aren't suing for breach of contract. The contract exclusion simply does not apply. This is a tort suit. We are not seeking damages for liability arising from contract. We're suing for damages proximately caused by a false statement carelessly made. And we ask you to treat this tort just like all the other torts of negligence. Don't treat people who commit the tort of negligence the same as those who commit intentional torts in South Dakota. And we'd ask you to reverse the decision and award a rule that there is coverage under this circumstance and that Judge Delaney erred by denying our motion for summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Thank you. Court will be in recess until 11.